Yeah, well, there's been no evidence to suggest that campaigns for one specific issue has led to a growing socialist consciousness. See, here, for instance, is a man, I'm quoting out a Canadian publication by our party called The Socialist Fulcrum. It's a man called Samuel Epstein, a doctor, wrote a book called The Politics of Cancer. He said this: if 1,000 people died every day of cholera, swine flu, or food poisoning, an epidemic of major proportions would be at hand, and the entire country would mobilise against it. Yet cancer claims that many lives daily, and most people believe they can do nothing about it. Now, it said cancer pessimism would probably not be altered by knowing that 70 to 90% of all cancer is made by man-made poisons in the environment and is preventable. But the reason they don't do it is it's the cheapest way to deal with it. And that's it. Now, here's a man who could claim, and I'm not too sure here, I've not read the book, but he's talking about the United States death rate of 1,000 people. He thinks preventable, dying every year because of the use of these pollutions, these poisons. That's happening every day. Now, no doubt he could come along and say, well, let's, I'm not saying he is, I've not read the book, but he could be saying, let's organise and let's demonstrate against this specific issue. Now, having done that, and probably been unsuccessful, going by the record so far, I am attempting to do this, having done that, that wouldn't have made people say, aye, this is another example of capitalism, let's organise for world socialism. And we think they're much better than dealing with that in a limited area. I mean, this is what reformist parties do all the time, and have been doing for a couple of hundred years. Maybe back in 1840, a man called Shaftesbury introduced a programme to abolish the housing problem. But of course, still got it. All that effort was put into that, and all that enthusiasm was engendered to it. But what it meant was that the buying and selling system carried on. So we feel, as members of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, on this particular proposition, that all that sincerity and all that effort, so I'm not down as 100% authentic, should be directed towards the major problem, the real cause of the problem, world capitalism. And that's how we feel. I mean, that's why the Socialist Party don't go out on limited objectives such as halting the nuclear waste dumping or halting pollutants or something of that nature. Yeah. Well, what we can say about world socialism is this, and in a sense it's rather negative, but we'll start off with the negative parts of it. We can say that there would be no owners and non-owners. In other words, the whole means of production and distribution would be owned in common. There'd be no buying or selling, there'd be no rent, interest, profit, wages, pensions, or any of these things. What there would be is men and women combining their energies to produce wealth to the best of their ability and taking according to their needs. That's what we mean by world socialism. The question of the amount of industrialisation and the question of how that society would be operated would be up to the individuals concerned. In other words, what happened would be this: is not only have we got common ownership, we've got democratic control. Should the majority of people not wish to live in cities, then there would be no cities. It may be inside a socialist society that some would decide to do that. It may be, of course, that if a modern city inside a socialist society could be a beautiful place to live. It'll be up to people to make those decisions. What we can say is this, that every means of technical advance that would anyway lessen repetitive or dangerous toil would be utilised. Wouldn't it be a question of returning to the ox-drawn plough or anything like that? If electronic advances can get rid of the back-breaking work, then it means that human beings can engage in activities that they find more pleasant. The important thing would be human needs. And I mean, I can't envisage a society, and how am I to know about this, but I can't envisage a society where anybody would ask to be do anything as awful as go down mines and drop their waste in water or carry on in any of that fashion. These things would be mechanised. I wouldn't do it, so I couldn't ask anybody else to do it. Nor would there be any of the dangerous, dirty, horrible things that men have got to do, that is, learn to torture and kill and maim people. There'd be none of that. So it's difficult for us to draw up a picture of world socialism. In 1904, when the Socialist Party of Great Britain was formed, I don't know what socialists would have said. What could he have said? We say everybody will have a hansom cab. Everybody will have their own gas mantle in the house. I don't know what they would say. But obviously the potential of modern society is immense, and I don't pretend to be any expert on that. What I do know is, what little I do know is, for organisations like the United Nations, that it's possible just now. The potential exists to feed the world three times over. Now, we've not got that just now. A third of the world's population is undernourished. It would be possible inside a socialist society for people to live in decent homes instead of the carry-on we've got now. So it's difficult for me to say exactly how it would operate. All I can make is a couple of suggestions, and you might have better ones. The one, for instance, that used to be a stumbling block for some of our opponents, would how would you have this democratic control? I mean, would we all have to meet in a big park somewhere and vote on every other issue? It wouldn't seem possible to have a democracy like that. But as we all know, with the advanced electronics, it's now possible and is used as a commercial proposition in the United States of America, as yet not fully developed, whereby you flick through your TV screen and see all the things that you want, or rather things you can afford, and then you press a couple of buttons, and then that's delivered to you, along with a bill, of course, a couple of days later. And not only can you receive information, you can feed information in. Now, technically, there's nothing to stop us having a situation where everybody on Earth, for all practical reasons, would be capable of recording what they felt about a specific local or global situation. I mean, the advance of electronics and associated sciences has made it possible to have this. I mean, I'm not here to give you an Isaac Asimov picture of the future, other than to state the basic proposition that we would common ownership, production for use, and people would cooperate to produce their best their ability and take according to their needs. The fashion in which they would organise it, it's not up for an old deadhead of me who's had 44 years living inside capitalism. It's for the people of that specific time. I mean, it's going to be their society, isn't it? And they have as much say on it as anybody else. Everybody will have a say in what happens. And it's up to society to decide what happens.
I just want to get back, because I thought the book is something hanging that was real. The question was, here's the working class who doesn't need capitalism. I say they don't want it, and they're trying to get rid of it. But clearly we all agree the working class doesn't benefit from capitalism. And the question is, what do you do? And it seemed like the suggestion was, well, we'll do our literature and whatever else, and the class will develop its consciousness and make socialism. And a friend here said, but there's no access to the needed ideas. And I think that's not quite right. I think there's no clarity of those ideas. There's no clarity of those ideas. I think there's a question of the struggle. I think that the speaker, and perhaps the Socialist Party, doesn't see it as a question of struggle. It's a hard struggle for the working class to find its way out of capitalism, to fight its way out of capitalism. And it's not a question of access so much of ideas. The voice of the working class isn't being heard, because there's no journal vehicle to get into. The working class will generate its own and has up and down in the past. But it's a vigorous struggle at every twist and turn. And that struggle can be helped for whoever wants to be of help to it by clarifying the ideas and the understandings of the laws of development of capitalism. And that struggle is ongoing. The struggle over the concept of value started with Petty, when a long time ago, and was developed through Ricardo, and Ricardo did a great deal of work, but but he left it contradictory, and some of that contradiction was solved by Marx, and that should be studied. That clarification of those ideas will give strength to the working class moving forward. There is something to do. I get the feeling that there's nothing to do from this presentation of Socialist Party of Great Britain. There's a fierce struggle to enter into and to support.
Sure, well, I agree with that, of course. I'm not saying that the last word in world socialism has been written, that when Karl Marx or Frederick Engels died, that was the end of it, and that we somehow or other are the disciples or the protectors of this socialist purity. I'm not claiming that. But what I'm claiming is this, that the ideas of world socialism have been formulated, the basis of the ideas of world socialism have been formulated. They're workable propositions. Not a question here so much of studying, although it's always worth studying. Not so much a question of studying the labour theory of value and any advances we can make on it. It's a question of applying that labour theory of value to modern day society. Does it work? Is it the answer? Is world socialism the answer? Now, we, of course, don't think there is nothing to be done. I mean, if you think there's an awful lot to be done. I mean, the very fact that there's only relatively here a handful of people at this meeting means that we've got an awful lot to do. But I mean, there are physical and mental limits to what a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain can do. I happen to work in the railway as a clerk. It takes up most of my time doing that. And I'm not making this a special pleading. I think this applies to every member of the working class. And it's just a normal day-to-day living that you've got to do. You've got to prepare to go to your work, you've got to rest and all the rest of it. Doesn't leave you a great deal of spare time, and it's only in your recreation that you can do something about this. But we're very conscious of the fact that what we need is not just more literature, but better literature. That what we need is not just more publicity, but better literature. We should have had thousands of posters for this meeting. We should have had umpteen newspaper adverts. We should have had a better speaker. We should have had a speaker with a lot of illustrations here. We should have used modern methods in order to communicate these ideas. So in a sense, because of the poverty of the working class, we perhaps are in an electronic age and we're still using rather prehistoric methods. But that's not because we've got the idea that nothing better can be done. It's all we have at hand at present. What we've got at hand, we're doing the best we have with our limited resources. And that's why we beg you to seriously consider the case of joining up with us, because we think we are the only organisation in this country that's committed to world socialism, that has an answer. All right, it can improve its case, and I don't doubt that for one instant. But that has got to be part of the process that world's working class plays. It's not going to have to be Dick Donnelly here, or the chairman here, or some member sitting at the back of the hall. No doubt they could be better socialists, and better informed socialists, more accomplished socialists, be able to put their ideas across. That's a process they'll have to set themselves to. But nevertheless, even if we were not all the brightest people in the world, the thing about it is, if a majority of the working class we're in a position of understanding the basic proposition of world socialism, we could get it tomorrow. What's stopping us just now is not a question that we've not refined a Marxism, honed it up to a fine edge. What's wrong at present is we've not got the membership. And that's what we are desperate need to now, is more socialists.
Yes, my point was similar to what my colleague. I tend to feel that the Socialist Party of Great Britain presents very nice points of view, but is unfortunately living in a world on its own. You have to be realistic. Instead of just thinking about all these wonderful thoughts of world socialism, we have to get things done. And that is why I feel that the Labour Party and other major parties are the best vehicle to see such a change. All right, so in the past we haven't seen much socialism from the Labour Party or any other socialist party throughout the world. But at least this is constructive, and at least we may, as time goes by, we may see some change result from these various political parties. The Socialist Party of Great Britain it's not doing enough. I appreciate your difficulties, but you must try and get more constructive things done.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's true, you see, it depends what kind of things you want to be done. I mean, as far as we're concerned, the thing that the Labour Party's done is a working class. I just mentioned in passing the record, but look at it. It supported two world wars. Socialist Party was opposed to them. And by the way, the Socialist Party were doing things then as well. They were out in the streets shouting against it, producing literature against it, and arguing against workers taking part in those particular holocausts. The Labour Party were doing things okay. They'd done things like nationalise the railways and half the amount of workers that were in it. The Labour Party have done things like bringing out the troops against gas workers, jailing some gas workers because they're on strike. They've brought out the troops in the docks. I mean, these are things that they've done. There's no doubt about it, they've been a power political party. But they're exactly the same sort of things that the Communist Party and the Tory and the Liberal and the Nazi Party were doing. Now, that's surely not the things you want done. Here are the only things that the Socialist Party of Great Britain has done. It's kept the case for socialism clear. It's never compromised the case for socialism. It's propagated it as best it can during such things as general strikes and depressions and world wars. It's put forward the clear case for world socialism. Now, as far as we're concerned, that socialist activity, that activity that's indulged in by the Labour Party, the Communists and the Tories and all the rest of them, is reformist activity. And the things that they're getting done, it's not things that we want to get done. The thing they're basically doing is they're the practical men that are running capitalism. And after all that effort, and by the way, I would say that the majority of supporters of the Labour Party are honest, decent men and women of the working class who sincerely believe that somehow or other the Labour Party is a bit different. But the facts are all against that attitude. The facts are there that the Labour Party's record is a stinking anti-working class one. So how could we possibly support it? There's no difference between them, as far as we're concerned, and the Tory party, as far as how they deal with the working class. So, while we might criticise the Socialist Party about not doing enough, I think that nevertheless, we've got to say that what we have done is in line with socialist principles. What they've done is in line with capitalist expediency.
That one of the pamphlets of the Socialist Party has a quotation from the man who was the chairman of the Parliamentary Labour Party, who was Lord Houghton. He said in 1967, he's a Lord, because they've been abolishing the House of Lords for a long time. What he said was, never has any previous government done so much in so short a time to make modern capitalism work. He was referring, incidentally, to the 1964 Labour government. Now, I don't accept, I mean, apart from the term that the speaker has mentioned, that we are limited by the amount of members we've got, the amount of money we've got, and the amount of ability we've got. I don't accept for a moment that the Socialist Party of Great Britain is an inactive organisation. In fact, I would go as far as to say that by looking at most objective standards of activity, you would find this organisation be more active than almost any others that speak about any kind of dissent from capitalism. If you look in the journal Time Out any week, which is the only one that advertises political meetings in the London area, you'll find more meetings organised by the SPGB and that than any other political party in the London area. You'll find a lot of meetings organised by all kinds of immediate reform campaigns, but as a general political party, more organised by us. If you look in this college, more meetings have been organised by the Socialist Party of Great Britain than any other political party. In fact, I would say than perhaps all of the other political parties put together. More general statements of what this party stands for have been put forward rather than the other party. More sales of the party journal than the other parties. This has been done, and it's done because people have to put in hard work. And it seems to me a rather odd position as someone who is presumably in some agreement with what we'll be doing, because you're saying we should do more, but at the same time, insufficiently in agreement to come and help us do the work. It would seem that the most useful way in which you could support the work that this party is doing is by joining it and doing it as well. But it seems to me that in a lot of universities in particular, and amongst a lot of the people who regard themselves as the leaders of the working class, there are people who see themselves, who not only happen to have a theory that the working class is not capable of understanding socialism, because that, after all, is what they have learned from Lenin, who said that the working class was too stupid to understand what socialism is about. But having adopted the theory, it just so happens they find that they are members of that particular group who have cut out the leadership. You don't often hear people talking about the inevitability and necessity of leadership when they reckon that they're one of the sheep who are going to do the following. It's always the ones who are going to be the leaders, so much so that somebody once came up with the slogan that students can only manage to reach a Leninist consciousness, which was an adaptation of something that Lenin once said. If you look at the way in which this leadership operates, where has it got people? What, in fact, has been the impact of that leadership? It has resulted in a lot of people looking towards people who stand above them to give them their answers, a lot of people who feel that they have succeeded in their reform campaigns because they managed to get whatever reform they were after, and a lot of people who have been so frustrated by not getting what they wanted in their reform campaigns that they become acquiescent, and there you had the beginnings of support a few years ago during a serious capitalist crisis for the National Front, and even now you get many people who were one-time supporters of the Labour Party because they thought it was radical, who now find themselves supporting the Tories because, quite rightly in many respects, they see that the Tory party is at least more experienced and more open about wanting to run a vicious competitive system in a ruthless manner. And that has been the legacy of reformism, there is no doubt about it. And however much our friend may want to, you know, argue his way around this, American workers went out in the elections last week and they voted for Ronald Reagan. And if they didn't vote for him, they voted for Carter. And if they didn't vote for either of them, it was not because they regarded that what was required was a complete change of society. It was because they were so acquiescent and so apathetic and so unconcerned with democratic change in society that they took no part in it at all. And what socialists are saying is it is, of course, a good thing if very often workers do say to hell with a lot of them and a plague on both their houses and whatever else. That is a very useful thing. But what is much more important is if, having made that decision, you go out and do something about it. You actually organise your alternative political views. You state where it is that you disagree with the major political parties. And by and large, what has happened is that most people who regard themselves as radicals either try to fit themselves in one of the political parties, and if it's not the Labour Party, then it's one of the Leninist parties, and if it's not that, then, and they're really down on their luck, it might even be the Liberal Party. Either they are doing that, or else the people who didn't vote in the American election last week were not sitting at home reading up and saying, ah, Marx has certainly improved on that theory of value from Ricardo. He's come up with a few good points here. Far from it. They were sitting at home watching Walter Cronkite or whatever he's called, or Mickey Mouse, or one of the other alternative political viewpoints that are put on for the working class. That's what they were doing, and that is the situation we have to face. The majority of workers, if you go out into the street now, as the speaker has absolutely rightly said, and has probably much greater experience of finding this out than I have, you talk to people, an alternative to government, an alternative to having to sell yourself for a wage or a salary, an alternative to producing bread for a profit, taking bread for nothing, running your own life, not having to do what your trade union leader tells you or what your boss tells you. People are not accepting that point of view. And that's what socialists have to do. And that is the one thing we have done. And as the speaker pointed out, in the First World War, socialists who didn't fight in that war ended up in prisons between 1914 and 1918. And it was incidentally the law of this country that if you didn't fight in the First World War, you lost your right to vote after the First World War. They were disenfranchised from even having the right to do that. Many people during the 1914 blacklisted weren't allowed to go out and get a job because their employers said these people are against the system we stand for. This party now has been disregarded by all kinds of people, has been sneered at, its members have been the subject of all kinds of political abuse. In the university system, its members have been discriminated against at work. Members who didn't fight in the last war were refused the right to stand even as trade union officials. I was at a meeting in Manchester a few months ago where a member was telling me that as a result of being part of the opposition to the last war, the opposition to supporting Churchill, his own trade union blacklisted him as ever having the right to stand as a trade union official for many years afterwards. These are the things that are happening. When this party was opposing the Stalinist regime in Russia, when all of the radicals were lining up in support of Comrade Stalin, what happened? Our platforms were being smashed up. In the 1930s, the Daily Worker published an editorial saying that it was official party policy not to speak to members of the SPGB in case you become contaminated by their anti-Stalinism. It was also unofficial party policy to smash up the platforms of the Socialist Party of Great Britain. So that on the one side, it was those people who supported the last war and who supported all of the atrocities of warfare who were smashing up our platform because they said we were pacifists, and on the other side, the people who were smashing up our platform were the supporters of Stalin. So this is the record of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, a record of not only having supported fascism in its most overt sense, when it's fashionable to do so, but opposing every limitation upon democracy, including the most tragic limitation on democracy of all, and that is the denial of human beings to have the right over their own decisions about how they will contribute to society and how they will have access to the wealth produced by society. That is a tremendous record in this party. And whilst in no sense am I complacent or smug about the SPGB's position, about the small numbers who attend this meeting, and about the fact that very few people are committed socialists, committed revolutionaries, committed Marxists, whilst we're not smug about that, and we're very critical of our own efforts, I think that what we have said in way of consistency, correctness, and accurate prediction about how capitalism would work has been something which is a record certainly in no way to be sneered at or to be disregarded.
I just want to make one sort of stable question. In my country, the people who call themselves revolutionary and radicals all say, we have a revolution, except the working class is racist and sexist, and so when they wash out this racism and sexism, then we can have a revolution. Now, it seems in this country, the SPGB says, well, the working class is unconscious of itself as a class, or unconscious of, doesn't understand socialism, and it doesn't understand socialism, we'll have socialism. So the problem in the world, according to the revolutionaries in my country and to the SPGB, is that the working class is the problem. It's either their racism, their sexism, or their unconsciousness. And their working class is not the problem, they're the solution. And they're struggling very hard to come forward with that solution. They need the clarity, that clarity is going to be developed through the struggle. And this total attack from everybody who calls themselves revolutionary on the working class betrays what class that attack is coming from. It's coming from the opposite class. And it's not how much work you do, it's who you're doing the work for. And it's what work you're doing. And this is not the work, telling the working class how ignorant it is, how apathetic, how it goes and votes, when the facts are it didn't vote. It didn't vote because there's nothing to vote for. The reason there's nothing to vote for, we can get into that also. But the reality is the working class is in motion. That's why we're here talking, because there's something pushing us behind us. And when we clarify it, they'll join with us and we'll join with them. If we can't clarify what we're doing, if we can't clarify that it's relevant and that it helps the class to understand itself and move forward, then we're not going to be accepted by the class, and they'll go their own way and make the revolution.
Offense come back, more or less, the same point again. Well, see, our viewpoint is that all these things that you call radical and socialist, you know, it very much depends who you mean by that and what actions you're talking about. I mean, you can do a lot of things. You can have demonstrations and you can do a lot of things. Like, I mean, there's all sorts of organizations in this country that use the term very, very loosely and call ourselves socialist this or socialist that and revolutionary this and revolutionary that. But the point about them all is they're all wanting to run the buying and selling system. Socialists can't combine with men and women, whether they're the working class or not, whose idea is that they're going to run capitalism, that we're going to have a money society, that their idea of a change, no matter what it may be, and they all vary to some extent, we're still going to have buying and selling relationships. We can't possibly combine with them. In our view, the only revolutionary stance you can take is the abolition of the wages system. Now, we don't take the viewpoint that we sneer at the working class and all the rest of it. You reiterated that again. But as I say, all our meetings are open to the public, and all our meetings are open to the widest possible discussion. Far from sneering at them, we are very, very much aware of the fact that the only class that will bring about world socialism is the working class. That the Socialist Party of Great Britain by itself cannot bring about world socialism. What needs is a conscious action of a majority of class-conscious workers. But that's not to mean that we'll combine with anybody who's in the working class or combine with anybody who loosely uses the term socialism. We think that only leads to confusion. And unfortunately, it's not the case, as you keep making out, that there's a majority of the working class who are fed up with this system. There is absolutely no evidence for that. I only wish you were correct. How much easier our job would be. So, that although you are taking the attitude that here's a small organisation, the Socialist Party of Great Britain, and its companion parties elsewhere, who are saying, look, we're right, and everybody else is out of step, that this is some sort of arrogance or bombast. It's not arrogance or bombast. I mean, we're prepared to argue the proposition. We're not just dogmatically stating something. The Labour Party have shown that they're in favour of nationalisation. Nowhere have they ever opposed the wars. Nowhere have they ever said they're in favour of the abolition of the wages system. Likewise, those other parties that you loosely call radicals and socialists, they're not socialist at all. So therefore, we can't combine them. Just this mere activity of you're doing something, that's the answer. That's blind and foolish. What is called for is thought. What's needed is action, but thoughtful action. Action in line with how capitalism develops. Action in line with the next stage in social evolution, the abolition of the wages system and institution of common ownership. I'd like to say in conclusion, fellow workers, that although we've had a lot of questions here, I don't know, 12, 13, some 14, something like that, I would like to say that the socialist case at first hearing might appear a bit bizarre. Even at second or third hearing, there may be large areas where you're in disagreement with us, and that is understandable. This case for socialism, unfortunately, is not self-evident. It needs a bit of inquiry. I beg you to start off with a bit of that inquiry. Get hold of the literatures. As the chairman says, I'm not expecting people to turn up at 3 meetings a day. That's just a wee bit too much. I'm not asking you to do that. But, you know, wherever it's possible, because we've all got our own lives to live, wherever possible, go along and engage in discussion with members of the Socialist Party. I can assure you, far from sneering at, we desperately need your support, and your very active support at that. With that, I'd like to thank you for a very kind and attentive hearing, most of all for your questions and your points of view. I've enjoyed it. Good afternoon.